It's that time again.
We go beyond the jive.
Join our hosts, John Swan and Natalie B.
Brave the sting of beekeeping to reap the sweet rewards.
All you hive jive junkies out there, this is the Hive Jive. Jive.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Miss
How are you?
Real Texas honey.
That's me right here.
Right there. We could just erase Texas off of that hat. And
you could ever just be since real you honey. Moved, you want to erase all of Texas.
Oh,
I've noticed the trend.
The things that almost came out of my mouth when you said that. We're going to change topics. Hi, everybody. How are you doing?
How's everyone doing?
That was actually really good. That was funny. It's not intentional. There are a lot of amazing people down in Texas that I had the opportunity to meet and get to know over the years. You are one of them. And so I definitely appreciate all of that. There are a small handful. It's just kind of like that whole old adage of, you know, like the one bad apple spoils the bunch. There are a handful of individuals that are involved in bee politics that I could care less about.
And to be specific, it's not necessarily about Texas. It's about specific people.
It is about specific people. It has nothing to do with the state. And that hat was designed by one of those individuals. But anyhow, the program itself stands for much, much better things than... She's covering it up. No, actually, Real Texas Honey, the program itself is actually a wonderful program, and I am a part of that. I still have Texas Honey. I can still put the labels on it that say Real Texas Honey, and I can sell it in the Ozarks.
And say this one is like special.
It's a commodity. You can't get this here.
That's right.
Well, we hope that everybody is doing well. We have a very interesting topic today that was brought to us by a listener. And the listener also, so they provided the article. And like most of these things, once you're told about it once or once you see it, it suddenly starts coming out of the woodwork. And then it's in your feed and other people start sending it to you. But Justin, one of our listeners, was able to find this and send it to us. And then Justin also has a question. We will loop in there with that a little bit down the road. But first and foremost, this is a fascinating kind of topic. It's something that I talk about in some of my presentations. I've got a presentation called The Intelligence of Bees, and part of that goes into their communication. I also have one called The Language of Bees, which also ties back into this. But as many of us out there have seen over the years, both honeybees and bumblebees and several different species of bees have really kind of blown the lid off of what we thought we knew that a bee or an insect was and could do and what they could comprehend and think of. There's all kinds of videos out there where you've seen people teaching the bumblebees to either pull a string or roll a ball or push a lever to get a reward. And then the astounding thing was that not only did the bees learn how to do this, but the thing that they did not expect was that the bees turned around and taught their sisters how to do the same thing. And therefore it kind of turned into this learning cascade, but it made a lot of scientists, researchers, and beekeepers stop and go, wait, what? So the articles that we're going to go over today, I will post both of them in the description of the episode so that you can go through, look them up and read them. The first one is an article from ARS Technica. And the second one is an article from the University of California. They both overlap a little bit. The first article talks about bumblebees and some of those things that I just mentioned, but then it goes into honeybees specifically. And then the second article from the University of California focuses solely just on the honeybees. And what these articles are about, in a nutshell, is the fact that the waggle dance is something that is not only inherently kind of known, but is also learned and taught to the younger bees by the older foragers. Right. And this has a lot of potential implications, but there's some really cool points. I have a list here of bullet points that I kind of wanted to hit on. Do you want me to go first with those, or do you want me to let you give your initial thoughts and then we dive in.
Well, I wanted to kind of reiterate the fact that most of the waggle dance, or the dancing language, which is a language among insects, is actually passed down genetically, is coded genetically, but the refining touches, or the teaching of the waggle dance, happens in the social units that the beehive is, and plays a very important part in how accurate and how efficient it is. Meaning they have that innate instinct to communicate through dance. And if they don't have any model socially showing them and teaching them how to dance, they will eventually still develop that because it's in their genes, but it will be completely, it won't be nearly as efficient as if they had learned it from their social peers, or it might be just kind of a different dialect, a different language. So I thought that, you know, that was important to kind of, did I steal some of your
you all laughing? Of them, you hit like all
oh,
of
no,
them.
I know.
But that, I mean, that shows you right there, like those are the key points in these articles that really grab you and catch your attention. And right. Literally, like, I can go into more detail on some of these, but that was, I was literally just going check,
no.
Like down my paper as you talked. Okay.
Yeah,
so
I was trying to make sure that we had the starting points with the actual implications, so we could kind of like extrapolate.
Yeah. Talk yeah. About it. So, okay. So here's the actual direct quotes from some of these things in here. So as you mentioned, the bees themselves are born innately with the ability to go through and dance. So they understand the concept. They kind of know how it should work. And in reality, I know we're not always, I love to anthropomorphize, I guess.
Yeah.
But I know we're not supposed to necessarily do that, but we're going to do it anyway. So if you put yourself into these shoes, right? We all grow up, we know how to dance. We know what dancing is, and we think we know how to dance. And we go to school, and there's the high school dances and things like that. And so, like, we know innately we want to shake and we want to move and we want to do fun stuff. But we actually have to learn the specifics of a lot of the dances from our peers and from people who already know it. And so they teach it down to us. It's the same thing for the bees. They're born with it. They innately know how to do it. And in these different, so both of these articles are referencing a couple of different research projects, and the research projects are separate from the articles, but there are links inside there and stuff that you can use to get to that. But what the research has found is that if you take a colony and you completely take away all of the older bees who know how to dance, mm-hmm. and you let that colony grow with just the younger bees, they will learn how to do the waggle dance. They will teach themselves. They will figure it out.
Right.
But the problem is they don't have anything else to base it on. So there's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of oopsies, basically, in the bee world, where they get some of the information wrong. And the biggest part of that is distance. So the original quote here from, I think this one, I took this quote from the University of California article. Bees, without the opportunity to follow any dancers before they first danced, produce significantly more disordered dances with larger waggle angle divergence errors and encoded distance incorrectly. Yeah. So they can do the dance, but the information that they're telling in the dance is not 100% accurate. Now, the other half of this is, in contrast, bees that shadowed other dancers in controlled colonies did not suffer such problems, like humans. See, not the only one that did it.
Right.
For which early exposure to language development is essential, bees acquire social cues that were encoded and stayed with them for life. Mm-hmm. Those that did not learn the correct waggle dance early on are able to improve subsequently by watching other dancers and by practicing. So there's a key thing there that's really important. Even the bees that learned it on their own and taught themselves, if given the opportunity to watch a more experienced bee do the dance, they can actually refine their dance skills and they can improve and they can get better and they can get more accurate. But there's a linchpin to this. Those bees, even though they have now learned and improved, they were never able to correctly encode distance. So even though they were shown the right way, they can do everything, but they still mess up the distance part of it. And that goes back to those early fundamental years of learning. Mm-hmm. In bees, it's the fundamental days of learning, because their life is like 38 days long for the forager and the worker. So in that aspect, though, it's really kind of interesting because it says that this distance encoding creates a distinct dialect of different honeybee species. In other words, the bees could never observe, or the bees that could never observe other dancing bees during their crucial early stages of learning development ended up developing a new dialect that they maintained for the rest of their lives. So they're actually speaking a different language, and it may not be discernible to bees from a different colony. If you were to mix them together, they may get the wrong information because that dialect or that specific language is different. It could almost be something akin to colloquial.
Yeah.
That's a really tough word for me to say, but where there are specific dialects or specific phrases, jargon that is used in different regions of a country, and they can kind of imply what you're trying to say, but they don't directly always mean the same thing. So
or they be completely opposite things.
Or they could be completely the opposite. That is absolutely true as well. So that right there is, it's a fascinating thing. I think the article itself, Okay. So I wanted to make sure that covered the rest of my bullet points that I had by reading the quotes.
Right. And I had that one as well about the dialects and the distance encoding. And I think what's really interesting is that once they've passed that window of learning, they will stick with that same dialect. It sounds like the article implied that they can no longer learn something else, unlike humans that can learn another language. But maybe bad habits when you learn how to drive will stay with you, you know, forever,
right,
kind of a thing.
Well, but even for people in language, though, and you should know this because you teach French, you speak multiple languages. But
right,
for like a lot of kids nowadays, they start teaching language in multiple languages in earlier and earlier years. So younger grades, you actually have kids that are already learning Spanish and French and things like that when they're really young, because that's when we actually grasp it the best. We can learn it the fastest and we understand it almost innately because our brain is still very fluid. As we get older as adults, it is harder to learn that new language because you're more set in your ways.
So, and this is kind of like off topic, but if you're doing it before 7 years old, it's going to be a lot easier, but it's going to require basically full immersion to really work, because you're not using grammar rules and you're not using your brains the same way. You're more like immersed. And when you're older than that, your brain can start rationalizing and understanding the rules of the language. So you're learning a more difficult way, but it's going to be faster for you to spend 1 hour and learn something that it would be for a five-year-old to spend just 1 hour and learn something.
Yeah.
So there's pros and cons to, I mean, there's a trade-off in both cases. And I don't know if that's even a parallel in the bee world, but it's fascinating that they have that kind of window. Like there was a story in France, I forget, the child of the Aveyron, I think, and he was lost in the woods and very, very young, and he was raised by wolves. And his language was basically the language of the wolves, and he never learned the language of humans because of it. It kind of turned off some neural pathways, which is probably something similar is happening with the bees, maybe. I mean,
it could be. The one thing that I know from experience is that the older I got when I would try to learn a new language, the more the rules of the core language would conflict and cause, like,
yes,
you to stop and think and question and have a hard time because your brain's like, no. And it honestly, people that know English as a first language is kind of at a disadvantage because English is the bass ackwards chopped up version of every other language. And when you're learning the other languages, you feel that way. You're like, well, but they say things in the wrong order. In reality, most of the other languages out there do it like that, and we don't. And so that's why it's that way. And it can be a little bit more challenging. But I do think, though, because the article states that they can watch and they can improve. So they're able to still learn, they're able to still get things, but that core of their language that was encoded to them when they were really young is what sticks around. And apparently the main part of that is the distance, how to actually accurately say this is the distance that it needs to be.
Right.
It's kind of a fascinating thing because it's both. Yes, we can learn new things, but at the same time, there's some parts that we're just stuck with.
Right. For example, you're never going to have the right accent.
Like, right.
I speak funny. Right. I mean, it's just impossible for me to completely get rid of my accent because I started learning it when I was like 11, 12, and it was already too late to acquire a perfect accent. But what I find going back to the bees is fascinating about this early language learning is that basically there's also mention of external threats being interacting or interfering, should I say, with the efficient learning of those languages. And for example, the pesticides. So I'm sure the article is mentioning pesticides that is referring to pesticides in the environment, but the environment is also inside the beehives. So it behooves us to find out or to ask ourselves at the very least, if us applying pesticides inside of the colonies for the purpose of treating pests and pathogens can have that early language disruption effect that makes your foragers less able to communicate distance and forage locations, and can in the long run negatively impact the efficient functioning and hoarding or foraging of the colony. And so how does it impact them over time? You know, I mean, we always study things like what's the LD50, the lethal dose at 450, and it's like a really short period of time. But I think it's interesting to look, it might be a good subject of research to look into what that does
to
language communication and their honeybee cognition and learning, right? Because they seem to mess up with their brains.
Well, so the pesticide effects, whenever CCD started happening, colony collapse disorder, and everybody was really focused on that and trying to figure out what was going on. And we realized it was really the perfect storm of these new parasites spreading disease easier, weakened immune systems, lack of natural forage and habitat, and high quality food sources, nutrition, the nutritional value, and then also the pesticides coming in there and wreaking havoc all together is what kind of creates and sets off that colony collapse disorder. So one of the things with the pesticides was that it messes up their navigation systems, which we attribute to they leave to go find their food, and then they can't properly navigate to come back home. And so then they just never return. And so your population is going down. But if you look at the other side of this, like you're saying, if you've also messed up their core language, so not just their GPS on how to find home,
right,
but their core language on where something is or how to actually articulate where the food source is, if they're telling it wrong, your colony ultimately will be spending way more resources,
exactly,
sending out way more foragers to places where there's not food. So it's not a beneficial trip. They're expending all this energy and they're bringing nothing back with them because they didn't find anything.
Yeah.
Yep. And they're half every time they fly, the flight is the most energy consumption the bee has. Mm-hmm. So they come back, they're going to gorge themselves on food so that they can refuel and go for another flight. So your colony is losing resources because it's expending more resources and it's not bringing anything in. So that very well could impact a colony's health overall. And we never think about that.
Absolutely. That's a very pertinent point. And then the other aspect of that that we don't think about is changing environment, especially in the context of decreasing forage or habitat and increase of pesticides to a certain extent, but also climate change and the seasons changing. And what happens then is if you have that early language learning that's interfered with, you might end up not being able as a colony to adapt to a changing environment, which is basically the hallmark of a culture. And that's what allows those animals to adapt faster, right? So that transmission of knowledge from one generation to the other is critical. And there's that kind of brought to me a point that I usually make when I teach beekeeping is the beeswax is an information highway, right? So part of it is like, I really don't like foundation because I think it dampens those signals,
right,
and makes the communication less efficient because it's muffled basically. But also, excuse me, still have allergies. The other aspect of that is that beeswax is lipophilic and it does retain a lot of the chemical messages, the pheromones, and it's basically holds the memory and the history of the colony from one generation to the other. I think that there is something to be said about that. It's not just from the insects themselves from one generation to the other. It's also in the beeswax, some kind of like fabric of culture, fabric of history, fabric, the memory of the hive.
All right. So I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was thinking for anybody who's listening to this and they're sitting there going, they're calling BS on that. And they're saying, no, there's no way. Let me put this into perspective. How the hell do you think records were made? They were a wax substance with a needle that vibrated and encoded a message onto the wax. So when you first started saying that, I was like, that is really fascinating. But then the more you talked about it, the more I was like, that's not as far-fetched as it sounds, because they communicate through dance. They don't see that dance. They feel the vibration of it. The vibration goes through the wax. The wax is a malleable substance. So therefore, yes, it could literally be etched and written into the wax in some sort of vibrational frequency. Like, it is literally stored in there, everything that's happened inside the hive. That's actually a really fascinating, almost mind-warping concept.
Right. And I'm more focused on the pheromones, because that's how they smell and they understand their world as well as the mechanical, you know, aspect of things. And that can very well be like the brood pheromones, like the queen mandibular pheromones and all their communications and Asanoff and all the stuff that can have that, that wax can potentially retain a whole lot of that. And I think there's more studies to be done on that kind of things. Yeah. And as always, I'm always worried about the interference we are causing the bees. So that's why I'm really trying to minimize that interference as much as I can, being a beekeeper who's already interfering by inspecting and all this stuff. But I know that people are saying, well, if you're going to be treatment free, you shouldn't open the box. You shouldn't put them in the box. And there's, you know, you know, life is not black and white. It's not everything or nothing. Let's be a little bit more
live in the gray area, people.
Dream about things and just realize that even though I'm a beekeeper, I can still keep my bees what I call treatment free by not putting any pesticides into my colonies for the sole purpose of curbing the pest and disease pressure.
So. Right. So I'm going to bring up something that I'm actually shocked that you did not bring up initially. So I'm going to give you the opportunity, because this is a perfect setup for you. So for everybody else out there, I'm about to throw you this huge curveball. Part of the whole discussion in here, as you get towards the end of the second article from the University of California, they start going more in depth on this dialect. And they start talking about, like what you said, the local environment and the dialect. Yeah. And they started theorizing that bees who are older, who are used to that area and environment, can better help teach the dialect that is specific for their locale. If there's always a water source here, if there's always a food source here, if this happens at this time of the year and this is where you go find it, and that never changes from that location. So if you take that, and you take that into the greater context of things, what does that imply? There's one thing you love to preach. People should always get
local survivor stock.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's exactly what I was going to actually talk about that. And I will go even further. I would say that's also important for the drones, because how do we know those drone congregation areas are being formed from one year to the other? Researchers still haven't found out what's the key to that. Maybe somewhere that's how it's done. Remember that drones are accepted from hive to hive when it's the season and they're not getting kicked out. And so they form a kind of a communication network. And probably, I'm conjecturing, but my instinct tells me that there might be communicating to all the hives in the area, what's going on, you know, what's the weather going to do, how the other colonies are doing, and all that good stuff. There might be a bunch of things that they're communicating with that if they don't learn some of those behaviors from some of their elders as well, that might be an issue for them to find those DCAs or communicate that way. But I'm conjecturing a little bit, but, you know, we don't know what we don't know.
That's true. We don't. And there is, I even say in my presentations, there are still a lot of things we can't understand or describe. When a bee goes through and they communicate these things, how is it? And I can answer a couple of these. Okay. How is it that the same damn dance can identify a water source, a pollen or protein source, a nectar source for carbohydrates, sources for novel, bizarre things like fecal matter, whenever they're actually combating the Japanese giant Asian hornets.
Hornets, yeah.
They are able to go out and find these certain things, propolis sources, different things like that. All of those things can be explained by the simple fact of they're doing the dance, they're telling the location, but they have a sample of it. They have a little bit of the substance that they're trying to say. So their sisters get to smell it, they get to taste it. So now they know what it smells like, what it tastes like, and where it's at. So they know where to go and what they're looking for when they get there. But the one thing that throws all of that out the window is when you start talking about nest sites and they're doing the exact same dance to identify a nest site. And when they do that, they're communicating everything that they have learned. And when they go to that nest site, they measure the entrance. They measure the circumference of the inside. They do little fly jumps until they have literally covered every square inch of the inside of the cavity. They measure and the humidity and the outside too. They measure the humidity. They measure the, you know, like the airflow and the drafts, all of that stuff. And that gets condensed down into how much quality is attributed to that specific location. And they come back and they communicate that stuff. And all they're doing in this point is a dance. Mm-hmm. They're not actually telling you, here's a sample of the food, you know, or here's this. They could carry back some odors potentially from there, but that's going to be it. And yet they can still communicate that stuff. And the bees understand, oh, we're not going to a food site. We're going to our new nest site. We're going to a new cavity. There has to be some underlying frequency or tone or something that they do, just like lots of other animals out there, where they communicate with each other through looks and gestures and some noises that we don't necessarily even consider, or in some cases may not be able to hear.
Yeah. And that's a very good point. My guess would be, personally, if I were to extrapolate again, would be they're in swarm mode, they're in bivouac position, and they know that at that point, the scouts are not coming back for foraging sources. They're coming back with candidates for a location that they can settle in. And that's when they go through the voting process. And my guess would be that they're not using it. They understand that's what it is. They understand their current situation. And they understand that the bees coming back to dance are talking about a new locale and showing the direction and the distance from there. And their excitement, the level of excitement for that specific locale. And they're trying to recruit the others to go and take a look and see if they would vote for that one as well. But the other thing I wanted to mention also is, you were talking about local survivor stock and the language that might be developed so that they can best communicate that knowledge. And there's evidence that if you move bees from one area to the other, they might not be also as well adapted to the proteins assimilation, the way they assimilate proteins from the local forage sources. And so there might be just as much, you know, it's important for them to be able to communicate about those environmental factors, but maybe it's also important for them to, they might develop a culture of digestion that's a little bit specific to their locale as well. So there's that. And then to come back to what you were saying, you know, the article was mentioning that if we remove some of those older bees and the nurse bees, the young bees haven't been exposed to their existing language, they're going to develop their own. And it might not be as good on direction or on distance. But the point is, if you do a split, what happens? Very often we take the old queen, we take brood and food, and we take a bunch of nurse bees, and we let the foragers fly back to the original hive very often, right? So what are we doing? We're orphaning those nurse bees from that language learning experience, that expertise. So I think there would be probably some interesting research to be done on the impact of doing a split that way. And if it wouldn't be better to try and include more foragers into the split, which can be hard to do, considering, you know, they would definitely return to the new place as you're moving the frames. If you are too shaky and you get bees up in the air, they're going to go back to the other one if they're foragers, right? So maybe be very delicate and maybe do it like at dusk before the sun goes down so that they are not wanting to fly around so much. I don't know. Those are just some thoughts that come through my mind about this.
So that kind of jumps into the question, Jen, that Justin had. So his question is, if these studies are able to be replicated and it suggests a culture, do you think that might impact how creating colonies is done and knowing that older bees train newer bees? An example, when starting a new colony, how might having the older bees absent make it harder for the colony to thrive? So that's exactly what you just went through and talked about. And it does have a lot of implications because, so number one, if we step back and we look at the whole local survivor stock thing, mm-hmm. if you're saying that bees from a locale know the better dialect for that specific environment, the whole concept of package bees becomes the most ridiculous thing in the world because you've got a queen that's from God knows where, and you've got a bunch of bees that are not even from the same colony that are all mixed together and shook down in there. Now, granted, you do get older bees. So you got bees that know how to do the dance and how to have the right precision. But the problem is they all get shoved into a package and then shipped 5 to 7 states away or further in some instances. So now you've got bees that, you know, started in Texas and they're up in, who knows, Arizona. Or you got bees that started in Wisconsin and now they're down in Florida. You know, it's like things that should never go together. Those bees can no longer communicate the proper things for that environment, even though they have all of the tools. The environment's not the same. It's not right. They can't give some of that specific dialect language to that. So that's the first challenge. And that's when you very first get your bees and you're starting, you know, maybe you ordered a package, maybe you got a nuke, but where the hell was that nuke raised? Was it raised in Oklahoma and you drove up and picked it up and then drove 2 states over to have it where it's going to be? Or, you know, were they raised right there a few miles away from where you're at? That's going to make a big difference. But then you get further down the road and you do exactly what you said. You're making a split. You're creating new colonies. And what do? We take all of the young bees and we put them over there. We do try to overcompensate, but it's only the young ones that are going to stay. All of the foragers go back to that other hive. Have we really set them up for success?
That's hard to tell. But that whole thing about the packages and mixing colonies together, it does bring back the reference of the Babel Tower, right?
Where Tower of Babel?
Tower of Babel. That's where everybody's speaking completely different languages. And all of a sudden you have a group of bees that can't understand each other. And it's got to be mayhem, chaos, pure chaos. And who knows if they ever, you know, get something that works really well. And that might be one of the reasons why packages are having a harder time to get settled than the nukes, probably.
That's very true.
To your point about moving the bees around, I mean, I think that as soon as you move them from maybe further than maybe a mile or so, you've already lost all that local knowledge, and that their language might not apply to the new environment in which they are. So they might be struggling from that as well. So when we move bees from, you know, one location to a mile down the road, we might already be impacting them.
Well, right. Especially initially when you first do it, because if you've got all of your foragers and they know there is a permanent water source that can always be counted on and it is right here, and you take them and you move them 2 miles in the other direction, they wake up that next morning and they're like, all right, ladies, here's what we got to do. We need some water. We have exhausted all of our reserves from overnight. Here's the location of it. And they do their dance and they tell their sisters, and the sisters leave, but they're 2 miles away from where they were. Yes, they reorient on their home and they figure out how to get home. But if they're still flying, say, you know, half a mile northwest, and you're now 2 miles over to the east, half a mile northwest is not going to land you in the same spot that it did when you were in that former location. So you could still be sending them to the wrong spot. They have to start over and they have to come back and be like, hey, look, you got to quit telling people that there's nothing there.
That's right. And that's why I like to talk with you about this kind of things, because we're uncovering a whole bunch of possible unintended consequences.
I 2 years down the road later, I'm like, we should have just named this instead of Beekeeper Chats. We should have named it Unintended Consequences.
There you go.
It's the UCs instead of the BCs.
But I really like that when we talk about this stuff, we try to have a critical mind and kind of look at different aspects of this, right? We're just really trying to see what are the possible implications of all of our actions and what's happening in the hive. And it's important, I think, that everybody, every beekeeper should care about that to a certain extent, because it really could be impacting their colonies and therefore their success rate, right? So that could be making you a better beekeeper if you think about those things more in depth and try to play the devil's advocate and what if, and kind of think about the deeper ramifications of our actions, meaning not just today, not just on this instant picture that you're looking at, but what could be the consequences on the brood, on the food, on the comb, on the queen, and that not just over today, but a week, a month, a year, and possibly longer, right? What is the impact that we're having on our bees?
It is. And that goes right back into Justin's question and the implications that he is insinuating there. If you have this knowledge and it is proven to be repeatable and true, and you now understand that there is a culture and a language, is that going to affect how you keep your bees? Are you going to change what you do?
Absolutely. I'm going to try to think about that when I do splits or when I move bees. I'm going to be very conscious of that. And I don't know what's the implications on my choices, on my methods yet, but I can guarantee you that when I do a split, I'm going to try to be very gentle and keep as many of the foragers that are supposed to be on the food frames, basically, and just kind of put them in there and not jostle anything until I have everything closed up and transported somewhere else. And at that point, if I have enough foragers in there, I don't want it in there in the same apiary, basically. I would really want to have them moved over 3 miles or so, because we've done splits, putting them on the other end of an apiary, right? And it's worked okay. But it doesn't mean it wouldn't have worked a lot better if we had moved them further away.
Right. So the only aspect of that I can see where you could control is where you do the split and you don't move it at all. You have it literally kind of right beside the parent colony, because in that instance, you can flip flop their locations with each other. So if all of the foragers went back to the one colony, you could flip flop those colonies and then you can balance back out with some foragers from the other one. I don't know necessarily like what the long-term thing is there though, because at some point they're going to eventually kind of balance themselves back out and become their own independent things. But that was one thing we used to do. I would do a split and I could do that split and set it, 3 foot away from the other colony initially. And if I didn't have enough bees in there, I could flip-flop their locations and get some of those foragers. That's fine and dandy. And maybe some of those older foragers could come in and teach and explain so that you at least have a new generation that has learned a little bit of it. But at the same time, if you do exactly what you said, you can put them into the container. You've got your foragers there. You move them far enough away that they're out of their normal zones of where they know all the sites, but you have to get them to reorient. You've got to make them come out and figure out everything's changed.
Come to think of it, I'm actually thinking that's not even as efficient as moving them to the other side of the property and forcing them to reorient by putting some branches or something drastic that's going to make them reorient, because they're still going to be in the same locale.
Yep.
And they're going to still be able to use the same language. And I just realized as we were talking that if I move them 3 miles down the road,
they're in a new locale.
Their language might not work anymore.
Right. You've changed the dialect, or at least the location of the known guaranteed sources of things.
Exactly. So how sensitive are they to that is also a question.
Yeah. Right? Now, this is not this last little thing here is not to upend everything we've talked about and not to give you a scapegoat on why you should not try to better your beekeeping. But the only saving grace that most of us beekeepers have is that the bees are extremely resilient and adaptable.
Yes.
They can adapt. They do adapt. They do it every time they're in a new different cavity style and space. They figure out how to actually lay out the comb. They work around obstacles. They can make it work. And we constantly challenge them with things that should never happen, like empty space above their head, above the last comb. Like that would never happen in nature, but we do it to them all the time. And they do adapt. They go through and they're able to do it. So I think that's the only reason beekeeping has been working for as long as it has, is that the bees adapt to all of our problems and issues that we constantly throw at them on a daily basis.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, I'm watching images of people in costumes, just kids in little bee costumes, and then there's a dance teacher in a big bee costume. So I was thinking,
teaching waggle dance.
What's really funny is that the older bees are dance teachers, basically.
Yeah.
And all the little nurse bees, they're just going to dance school.
That's right. They're going to dance class. They're growing up to be professional dancers.
That's right.
And it earns a living. Dancers. That's how they get their food.
Exactly. I feel sorry for the ones that have 2 left feet.
Ooh.
Or actually I should say 3 left feet.
That is true. On a bee, that would be 3 left feet.
No, actually 3 left feet would be normal. For the ones that have 4, 5, or 6 left feet. That's what I get for trying to anthropomorphize.
Yeah, you tried to put it into perspective and it you had it right on. But yeah, that would be exactly the number of left feet they have. Well, hopefully this conversation about how bees learn and how bees teach each other has made you learn something, or maybe taught you something that you can use in your own beekeeping, or at the very least, it's made you stop and think and question, are there unintended consequences for what I'm doing? And is there anything I can do to help make it easier for the bees and easier on me by not constantly going against the grain every time I open the colony?
That's right. Yeah. So that's why it's important to
be mindful.
Oh, yes, we did it.
All right, everybody. Well, we hope you've enjoyed. We look forward to talking to you again next week with a yet to be determined topic, because who knows? But until then, as always, I'm going to make you say this one.
Be good.
There you go. Because I already said be mindful, everybody. So have a great day. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
This Hive Jive production was made possible by amazing patrons like you. And we appreciate your support. To all our Hive Jive junkies out there, you truly are the bee's knees.